So hi, my name is Didier Van Hooyer. I'm a Microsoft MVP amongst many other things. So enough about me for now, let's dive in. And we're gonna talk today about what's new and enhanced in Windows Server 2016 failover clustering. So that's a mouthful. Let's try to get this to work. So let's start with troubleshooting. I know that for many, troubleshooting will never be fun, but the idea is to make it as easy and pleasant as possible, at least. So one of the improvements is with Get Cluster Log. What it does now, it gives you a very clear indication whether it's using UTC or local time. And it will give you the offset towards UTC, Greenwich Meridian time. And it will even indicate if you have daylight saving times enabled. So that's very easy to coordinate the cluster logs from multiple hosts with the support people at Microsoft. What they also do is they dump the cluster group resources information into comma separated values into the log, so you can easily read and parse them with your favorite tool, whether that's Excel or something else. They've got a new event channel, the diagnostic verbose event log, which basically logs level 5 cluster events into the event channel. Why is this useful? Well, it's a separate event channel, so your normal event logs aren't overrun with too much detail during normal operations, and they don't roll over that fast. But when you have an issue, all the details are there in the log. Because otherwise, Microsoft support would ask you, could you elevate your logging and reproduce the problem or wait until it happens again? You don't have to do that anymore, the information is there. What they also do is they add all the other event logs that are relevant to that cluster log, the system log, the cluster aware updating log, the operational cluster log. So in one command, you actually get all the information they need from you without them having to come back a couple of times to request that information, which is a great improvement. What is also new is the active memory dump. So the default now is the automatic memory dump. That was an enhancement because if you have a 1 terabyte memory server and you're only using 800 gigs of that memory, your memory dump will be 800 gig. But still, that can be large. And especially in Hyper-V, most of the information in the memory dump, if it's complete, isn't relevant to the issue on the cluster host. So you only want the information that's relevant to the parent partition. That might be 6 to 15 gigabytes, depending on what you're running on there. So how do you do that? Well, you enable active memory dump. And basically, that's only a registry key or two. What you see here, and let me get over here. Crash dump enabled 7 is automatic memory dump. If that's set to 1, it means a complete memory dump. But then they add a registry key filter pages set to 1, and that filters out all the irrelevant information. That's how it works. You can set this in the GUI, or you can use PowerShell. If you do use PowerShell, that filter pages value isn't there by default. So if you query it before active memory dump is enabled, you'll get a nice error. But that's about it. That was troubleshooting enhancements. And some people don't like troubleshooting, so let's dive into what's the good stuff. What's new? Well, one of the most important ones, of course, is rolling cluster upgrades. So today, it becomes possible to migrate without creating a new cluster from a 2012 R2 environment to a 2016 environment. Why is this so important? Well, Microsoft is pushing towards an ever faster release cycle and ever faster updates and functionality. One of the challenges there is getting people to upgrade accordingly to that cadence Microsoft is setting. So what you need to do to make that happen? You need to make it easier, and you need to make it less risky. So easier is no new cluster. You just keep your existing cluster, and this works with just your existing hardware. You evict some nodes, you reinstall them, you put them back in. So it's easier. And the risk? Well, the risk reduction comes from two factors. One, until you flip the switch, you can always go back to 2012 R2. So if you run into an issue that's really blocking you, you can go back. That wasn't possible in the future. It was a hassle to go back, create yet again a new cluster, etc. Secondly, the virtual machine configuration files the version of it, isn't updated automatically anymore. This means that your virtual machines, even when they're running on a 2016 cluster, and you haven't upgraded the version of the configuration, you can move back to 2012 R2. Otherwise, in the past, it was restore from backup, restore from snapshots, whatever. It was a very painful experience, especially if you had to do it 2 weeks after you migrated the VMs, because those backups from that time period might not be exactly what you want to restore. So that risk has been taken away. So basically, how does it work? Well, you start out with your 2012 R2 cluster. Let's say you evict one or two nodes. You cleanly install Windows Server 2016 on them, and you rinse and repeat. Do note that during this phase, you are still on cluster functional level 8, being you don't have the new capabilities of 2016 yet. This is what they call mixed mode. Once you're done, all your nodes are Windows Server 2016, but you're still at cluster functional level 8. When you think you're golden, no firmware issues, no driver issues, you think, hey, this is all hunky-dory, I'm happy, I'm going to flip the switch, I'm going to update my cluster functional level, and I'm going to have all the new capabilities from Windows Server 2016. Now, is it all perfect? Well, you can only upgrade that way if you're on 2012 R2. To the best of my knowledge, there are no plans to move this to previous versions of Windows. In-place upgrades are not recommended, so to speak. Technically, you can do them. Stating that they are unsupported is a bit too much, but they are not recommended. So draw your own conclusions there, right? You should always use a 2016 node to add a 2016 server to a cluster. You should always manage your mixed mode cluster or your compatibility mode cluster from a 2016 node. And as you do the upgrade, you should plan to move through swiftly. Why? Well, there's no use in remaining in that mixed mode for 6 months or a year, heaven forbid. Move through them as quickly as possible without inducing risk. But don't stay there, okay? And last but not least, what you should remember is don't think about restructuring your storage environment whilst you're doing that upgrade. If you have any big plans to reorganize storage, do it before the migration or after the migration, but not during. The storage capabilities of the two versions are not the same. So if you start doing things in storage, they might lead to bad experiences on some of the nodes, so just don't go there. Another very nice feature, one that I'm very fond of, is virtual machine compute resiliency. And in essence, this is a more elegant way to deal with transient errors. Clustering is great. Clustering is like a bodyguard. There is a clear and present danger on one of the nodes. They shoot it in the head, and they save the workload to a better place, another node. Which is great if the threat was really that dangerous to the health of the workload. However, there are threats that are not that dangerous. And then this shoot first and ask questions later policy is a bit overkill. So you want a bit more finesse in the entire process. And that's exactly what this offers you. So if you have a node that disconnects from the cluster for a short amount of time, or even part of the cluster, it can see some of the nodes but not all of them. Or heaven forbid your cluster service crashes and is unavailable for 30 seconds for whatever reason. Instead of just crashing the workload, failing it over to another node, we now have a better way. So the node goes into an isolated state. That means it's not part of the cluster anymore, functionally. The virtual machines running on that cluster are in an unmonitored state. As you have no cluster functionality, from the cluster's perspective, it cannot tell you what's happening with the virtual machine, so they call it unmonitored. However, a virtual machine can run perfectly fine if it has all its resources without having a cluster. So if you are on scale-out file server with SMB, which is external to the cluster, you've got your storage. So the virtual machines actually are running. And you can see this in Hyper-V Manager. If you're on CSV, well, it's not that beautiful. Because CSV is gone the moment you don't play in the cluster anymore. It's a clustered resource. But instead of crashing the virtual machines and failing them over, the virtual machines actually go into a past critical state and they can resume from that. That's how they handle it with CSV. Now, of course, you could have a situation where that transient problem is reoccurring and reoccurring. You have this flapping issue. So you don't want a flapping node in your cluster. It's problem, no problem, problem, no problem. By the time you want to troubleshoot, it's gone again, it comes back again. So there's a threshold. By default, if you have the issue more than 3 times within the hour, the node becomes quarantined for the default period of 2 hours. Then it tries to rejoin, rinse and repeat. If it's still not fixed, it happens again, repeatedly, it will be quarantined again. If you go in as an administrator, you fix the issue, you know the node is good, you start the cluster node with a clear quarantine flag, and you're back in business. Now, all the behavior is customizable. You can set that quarantine duration and threshold, and you can also set how long a virtual machine will be in that unmonitored state. By default, that's 4 minutes. And the resiliency level has 2 modes. Always isolate, or only isolate when you have a known issue, like the node isolation or the cluster service crashing. The story is even better. You have virtual machine storage resiliency. When a virtual machine loses its storage, normally it's going to crash. But now it goes to a past critical state, up to 30 minutes by default, which is configurable. If the storage reappears on the node, the virtual machine can resume from pause. Now, not all workloads will support that. I'm pretty sure somebody in Redmond now is writing down, Exchange DAC servers do not support this. That's why you can configure it for a virtual machine. So, there you go, you can do that. The story is pretty beautiful with CSV, and even a bit more prettier with SMB. Because in SMB, of course, you already have the fact that during 1 minute, you can survive problems due to the persistent file handles of SMB3. Otherwise, it's also past critical. Now, with a guest cluster, with an AVGX, you have even a better scenario. Guest cluster node doesn't have to go into past critical mode. It can be just disattached from its VHDX. The workload fails over to the other guest clusters and nodes, and it's up and running. When the storage comes back, the VHDX is reattached to the guest cluster node, and it can rejoin the guest cluster. So there you don't have that past critical condition. Now, of course, for this to work, you should be using anti-affinity with guest clusters, because otherwise you run the risk that all the guest VMs are running on the same cluster node that has the underlying storage issue, and basically you're toast anyway. So you don't want to do that. Other goodies we're getting in 2016 is simplified SMB multi-channel. So what does that mean? Multi-channel actually doesn't require multiple subnets to work. But clustering does, because clustering up until 2016 only uses one NIC per subnet. So if you wanted to do multi-channel for CSV or live migration, you had to create 2 subnets and get multi-channel. This is gone. So the cluster validation won't nag you about it anymore. It's fully supported for SMB workloads. You get 1 cluster IP address registered for the network names. It's compatible with IPv6. It's a good story. Why did they do that? Well, in a lot of environments, people weren't too happy with the fact that you had to get another subnet. Believe it or not, there are places in the world where getting an extra subnet is asking way too much. I know. I mean, I'm like, really? But apparently it is. And also, clustering networking wasn't consistent with the multi-channel story. Multi-channel doesn't require multiple subnets. Why does clustering do so? And secondly, SMB is used in ever more use cases. It's now used for storage replica. It's used for storage spaces direct on top of all the other workloads. So they had to make it easier for people to adopt it to deliver the throughput that storage spaces direct, flash only, NVMe disks, ever better memory and compute delivers. So that's why we got that. One of my favorites, node fairness. What does it do? Well, if one of the nodes in your cluster is not pulling its weight, the VMs can be redistributed amongst the nodes to make sure they are all working and you're not wasting resources. That happens more often than you think in environments where you test something, you had a failover, you had an upgrade go bad, or a Windows update go bad on the host. Some of the hosts tend to be a bit more idle than the other ones, or even empty. Now you can set this to on. You can set it to only do this at node join, or do it at node join and then every 30 minutes. And then you can decide on the aggressiveness. And there's an error on the slide, which is not my fault. If you look at the mode, you can set it to kick in when one node is loaded 80%, when a node is loaded 70%, and then in TP5 we should have gotten kick in when one of the nodes is on average more than 5% loaded than all the other nodes in the cluster. But actually it's not true. It's not happening in TPV5. It's actually just loaded at 60%. So this was in the documentation. I think it's changed now, but beware of this. But this is the end goal for RTM, so just you know that. So I left it on there. At RTM, it should be that. And this is also a nice one, something a lot of people have been asking for a very long time, and that is virtual machine start order. You can actually state now when a virtual machine should boot and come up. So you can say, hey, I want my network appliance VMs, my storage VMs, to be fully booted and operational before my other VMs start. Or you want that, you can do that to your domain controllers. They have to be up and running before the other ones start. And it becomes even better. You can create groups of virtual machines and create tiers that way. You could say, hey, I want my database tier to be started before my middle tier starts up. And I want my middle tier to be up and running before my front-end tier starts up. And that's possible now. The grouping, of course, is one thing. The other question is, what constitutes up and running? So up until now, a VM was considered to be up and running on power on self-test during the boot process. But that doesn't mean your storage is available, or the network functionality is available, or EAD is available, or whatever. So now you have indicators and triggers that determine what is considered to be up and running, either at the VM level or at the tier level. So that's kind of nice. It's early days yet. It's not completely finished, to the best of my knowledge. But I like where things like this are taking us. So enough talk. Let's do some demos. So we've got a very nice cluster here. It's a three-node cluster. And as you can see here, oh, this is not working, is it? Not for you anyway. I was having fun. Is it coming now? OK, so again, we've got a very nice three-node cluster here. And when you look at the networks of the cluster, you can see one network named same subnet multi-channel. So if you bear with me, and you see this node, Windows 2016.1, it has two NICs, and those NICs are exactly on the same subnet. And they show up in cluster networking. That is new. Normally, in any previous version, if you had two NICs on the same subnet, you would only see one. And cluster validation wizard would be nagging you about, hey, that's not supposed to be like that. You're not going to be able to use that. So now, just to prove that this really, really works, let's take a look. This is live migration. Single subnet, two NICs used, and just for fun, it's Rocky RDMA, just because that's how I roll. So that's the fun part here. But there's more. You've got a little VM here. That's one of the resilient VMs I have, and they are running on scale-out file server, so on SMB3 storage. So I'm going to ping one of the nodes in my environment. Let me complete this. Oh, great. This is a motherboard layout. What is this? OK, hang on. Should that do it? Would that do it? Yeah. I'm pinging one of the nodes in the network outside of the VM, and let's start. Okay, the VM is being pinged as well. So that's cool. Now let's make sure that we look at the right node. We go to node one. We see three VMs running here on the scale-out file server storage. And what we also need is Hyper-V Manager. And here you see that the VMs are running. So now we are going to misbehave. We're going to be very bad persons, and we are going to start playing with the health of our cluster. So we're going to crash the cluster service. What you'll see happen, the virtual machines are running, the node is isolated, and these are the demo gods, I guess. Please. Ah, there they are, up and running again. Next time, we'll probably see it. It's up and running already again, so we're going to create a second issue, and let's hope we see the unmonitored state. There we go. That's what you're supposed to see. Isolated, unmonitored. But do note, they are running. The pings are still going on. Nothing is happening to the workload. Your customers are very happy still. No issue whatsoever. Now, of course, we are playing at a flapping issue. It's a transient error that goes away, but it keeps reoccurring. So what now? We do it again. It goes into isolated mode again. They're still running. Normally, the node will come up again, but it's three times within the hour, so the node is quarantined. The VMs are still running. But we know we have a persistent issue of transient failures on that node. So keep watching what's going to happen. They're going to be live migrated off that host. That host is quarantined. It will not be used until you fix the issue or until the quarantine default time period expires. By default, that's 2 hours. But you can tweak that. So there we go. This is one of the really nice improvements in clustering, you know, that finesse that you don't really shoot everything in the head and fail it all over, even if it's not necessary. That little glitch in the network, that little hiccup, it's not that, let's say, catastrophic anymore, because however good it is in case of a catastrophic failure that everything is crashed and failed over to another node, with these little issues, it's overkill. You actually cause more harm than good, and you don't want that. So that's what they're fixing with this feature. That's the intention. So let's go back to the presentation. Oh, you're going to get to see the curtains again. Cool. So what else is new? Well, now we've got this beast called workgroup and multi-domain clusters. Say that again. You can build a cluster in a with nodes that are not member of a domain. They can be in a workgroup. They can even be members of multiple domains, multiple Active Directories. That's new. Very interesting. How do you access the workloads on the cluster? Purely by DNS. And that's why you will see that if you create such a cluster, the command for that is administrative access point, it's only DNS. Normally it says Active Directory and DNS. That means that your DNS, it has always been extremely important. Now it's even more important, of course, because that's the only thing you've got. So if I have to tell you that your DNS has to be healthy, you might want to follow some training or something. Yeah, that's my take on it. Why would you use this? Well, the main purpose of this is SQL Server workloads. And Microsoft has some very specific scenarios in mind for this. So first of all, as you have no AD or multiple ADs, the way to go is to use SQL authentication. So just for the demo here or for the talk here, forget what we've been telling you for 15 years, use Windows Integrated Authentication. Perhaps it's not such a great idea in all scenarios. But the workloads they're looking at is database mirroring. Database mirroring is being depreciated. It's going away. After SQL Server 2016, it will be gone, which means that you need something else. That something else are availability groups. The problem is availability groups are dependent on AD. So for that scenario to work, AD needs to be not required, and that's what they're doing. You could do file server, you could do Hyper-V, but you lose all the Kerberos goodness. Some of that goodness is real good, so you don't want to lose it, so that's really not recommended. And then there are some workloads like message queuing that, well, they store their properties in AD, so no AD, it's not going to work. But it's a new capability you have. Other scenarios are DMZs, environments where you might not want to have AD or you're not allowed to have AD, but you still need high available SQL Server. Well, this is the approach they're taking. That scenario and some others require something, a witness. If you have no AD, you can't do ACLing based on AD, so you can't use a file share witness, only a disk witness or a cloud witness. So what is a cloud witness? Well, a cloud witness is exactly the same in functionality as a file share witness. The beauty of it is that it's in Azure on standard blob storage, which means that you no longer need that third data center, ideally, to make it work. So it becomes a lot cheaper and easier for a lot of people to implement this than telling them, hey, you need to have a third data center. What were the options? Put it somewhere on a cheap server or the PC in a branch office for high availability? Really, not a good idea. Or let's extend our AD to Azure. Let's build a high available file share cluster over there and put a share witness on there. So that's so easy and quick just to get a little witness. Not a nice story again. Perhaps you can't do that. Perhaps you don't want to do it. Perhaps you're not allowed to do it. So this solves all these issues. Now, it's easy. I've done it a couple of times. I was skeptical at first. I did it and I was like, am I finished yet? Yes, it's up and running. It uses one storage account. You can put thousands of clusters in one storage account if you want. The traffic is minimal, so it's not costly. But of course, it uses REST. So you need HTTPS access to that cluster witness, to that cloud witness. So that's either over the internet, over a VPN, or ExpressRoute. For some people, this won't fly. In highly secure environments, it might not be possible. But for most people, this is the solution to that need for a third data center with a file share witness, and you can use this with your workgroup cluster. The cloud witness, that's what it looks like when you set it up. And as you will notice, you have an access key here. An access key is actually what you use to configure the cloud witness. You can do this in the GUI as well. You just pass the access key. That creates a secure token, security token. That security token is stored securely on the hosts. So the access key itself is not stored on the cluster nodes. And that security token will remain valid until this is changed by you. That's why you have two. You can swap them over and do maintenance and replace the access key if you need to, or are required to by some policy. And if you look at the file it creates, this is now for one cluster. That file has a GRID name. And what is that GRID? Well, if you dive into the registry where you can find the cluster information, it's actually the cluster instance ID. So if you have 1,000 clusters running with a witness, you would see 1,000 files here and you can identify them by that cluster ID. I need a drink. All that talking. So, what else is new? Enormously welcome improvements to stretch clusters. They've become site-aware. And this has been made possible by the fact that now you have a concept of fault domains in a cluster. So one of the types of a fault domain is the site. So to set up a site-aware stretch cluster, you define a fault domain of the type site, and I've amply named them Bonn and Köln because we're in Germany. And the distance is about right to do a stretch cluster replica. And then you assign the nodes of your cluster to those sites. So half of them to Bonn, the other half to Köln. And when you've done that, all of a sudden, all the placement and heartbeating activities of that cluster take the site into account when they do something. So the failover, the placement of the resources will be tied to the sites. They won't do stupid, silly things like moving things across sites, so the data has to move across sites. Also, the VMs follow their storage. This is a very important concept. The VMs follow their storage, which means that if the storage moves, the VMs move. Just keep that in mind. You can set a preferred site. That's at the cluster level. When you do that, you say, hey, my primary site is bomb, and the other site, Kerlen, becomes the disaster recovery site. What does that mean? Well, everything that happens with a resource like a VM, a cold start, a node drain, a node failover, the VMs come up in a node within its own preferred site. They won't fail over to a node in the disaster recovery site. It also means that the entire game you have that dynamic quorum introduces and plays with assigning votes and taking votes away from the witness and the nodes will always favor that preferred site. That is the one that has to be kept up and running if needed at the cost of the other things. And the CSV load balancer, of course, that will only work within its preferred site. There's no use why the CSV would go to the disaster recovery site, heaven forbid, because the VMs follow their storage. You don't want that. It becomes even better. We used to have this really annoyingly hard to pronounce property, lower quorum priority node idea, to which you assigned the nodes that you wanted to be victimized in case of a very specific scenario. It's a bit of a nightmare scenario. One, the cluster for some reason has no witness. Secondly, you lose the connectivity between the two data centers. In other words, where does the cluster live now? We don't know anymore, and there can be only one. You don't want a split brain scenario, possible data corruption, etc., etc. So now it's that preferred site that's used to determine this is the site in such a scenario that will survive. So all the messing around with that lower quorum priority node ID, it's gone. You don't need it anymore. It's depreciated. Multi-active data centers. You can actually set a preferred site at the group level, meaning that, hey, we can now actually have half of our VMs run in Bonn, the other half in Köln, and they will play disaster recovery data center for each other. So that's a preference you can set at the group level. For VMs, this is quite easy to comprehend. For SQL Servers, it's the same thing, but you just need to keep in mind that with SQL Servers, it might not be such a smooth experience as with VMs that can fail over without interrupting the workload to the consuming applications. Now, is this something that you'll see always in action? Well, there's a preferred way of doing things. First of all, you've got this storage affinity. The VMs will follow the storage. If the storage is equal for all cases, then it will follow the group preference. And if that preference is equal or not available, it will use the site preference. So that's the priority you've got there. Failback. Failback is quite new. You can actually say that resources have to fail back automatically. By default, this is turned off, because people might want to decide for themselves when things go back. However, if you turn it on, within 5 minutes, the workloads will start moving back to the preferred site. You can tweak this, and you can say, hey, I only want this to happen between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., because then people are not at work, and the overhead and the possible interruptions are minimal. And is it something that you should set on all possible resources? Well, probably not. In the case of VMs, what did we say at the beginning? VMs follow the storage. So if you set that failback behavior to the storage, the CSV goes back to the preferred site, and the VMs will follow automatically. So you don't have to assign it all over the place. You could just pick the best resource for your particular situation and let that kick in, and the rest will happen automatically. It's fairly new. It's not that easy to play with yet. So I haven't done too much with it, but I'm looking forward to testing it out and seeing what happens. You could have also the possibility to enable auto site configuration. In that case, your sites for your cluster will be determined by two things. If you have Active Directory subnets, those will be used. If you don't have AD subnets, it will be the cluster network subnets that will be used. This is off by default. I'm guessing that if you haven't designed your Active Directory sites or your cluster network with this process in mind, you might not want to get the result that you desire. So this is off by default. But if you have designed with this behavior or this capability in mind, you might want to leverage it. Also pretty new to all of us, so we'll see what we can do with that one. And then, of course, there's the site-aware hard-beating we've got now. We already had same subnet hard-beating. We had cross-subnet hard-beating. And now we have site-aware hard-beating. So what is going to happen? If you have multiple nodes in two different sites on two different subnets, well, there's two different sites, so site-aware hard-beating, if it's going to be used. If you have two nodes in two different sites on the same subnet, still subnet threshold for hard-beating will be in play. Again, why? You have two sites. Now, if you have one site and two subnets, it will be the cross-subnet that kicks into action. So not the same subnet, not the cross-site. It's the cross-subnet settings that will play. Now, if you have two nodes in the same site on the same subnet, business as usual, it's that same subnet setting that will kick in. Now, if you have played with this before, note that the default for the same subnet has been increased a little bit since the previous versions. And the ones for the same subnet and the site, they are at the same level. And this is tweakable. You can try to set them to get the best possible behavior for your own environment. The only rule is don't go overboard. Don't set this to ridiculously high values, because then the entire mechanism to protect you from downtime will fail. Storage replica is extremely important for the very reason that this is the very first time in history that Microsoft has a complete solution for stretched clusters. Until now, if you wanted to do a stretched cluster, Microsoft would sell you everything you needed, and then you say, okay, cool, I'm going to do this, I'm going to implement it, and sooner or later, depending on your level of experience with this technology, you would come back to Microsoft with the question, how do I get my storage to the other data center? And they would say, oh, you replicate it, and how would I do that? Well, you go buy a storage solution from a hardware vendor or a software vendor, and you implement it, and if everything works, you can continue. Oh, okay. So now with storage replica, one of the supported scenarios is a stretched cluster. For the moment, it was synchronous replica only. I think they are considering if they can do something else with asynchronous, but we'll see if that happens. But if you do synchronous and you don't have a tremendous budget for dark fiber and boosters and repeaters, your maximum distance will be around 35, 45 kilometers, depending on the quality of the equipment you use, because basically you lose signal quality and there's only so much of a distance you can traverse synchronously, okay? But the good news is this is in-box technology and it works with SMB, so it works with multi-channel. Hey, that same subnet multi-channel thingy comes in handy here. And it works with RDMA, it works with iWarp, it works with Rocky even. Go figure, nice. And if you look at the technology around RDMA, you'll see that some vendors are doing some pretty cool things to push that Rocky across very long distances. So, storage spaces direct. This is actually something you build with a cluster. It's a cluster feature. So it's an addition to the storage spaces we already had, or the storage spaces solutions we already had. We have two big different approaches. One is the hyperconverged approach, which you can have in a model where you only consume direct attached storage to the servers, or where you also leverage JBODs attached to the servers. Those are the hyperconverged models where everything is in the same cluster. The storage, the compute, the virtual machines, everything. And then there is the model where you have a disaggregated situation, where you actually build a scale-out file server on top of the storage spaces direct, and then over the SMB fabric, you consume that storage with one or more Hyper-V clusters or SQL Server clusters or whatever workload that supports CSVs, or at least SMBs in this case, sorry. Other new things we get, the health service. The health service is quite new, and what it does is it can monitor the health of hardware. It can monitor the health of your cluster hardware. It can monitor the health of your storage hardware. It can also monitor the health of your storage spaces software stack. Is everything okay in your storage spaces? Do you still have redundant copies? Hey, is your storage replica we talked about, is that still functional and working? So it can check that. There's a new concept that's called storage quality of service policies that are distributed policies across the cluster. It can check the health of that as well. Are your storage cost policies being met or not? And do you have to do something? Now, how does that work? Well, actually, that health service and that fault domain concept, they go hand in hand. We've already talked about fault domains. We were using them in our stretch cluster scenario to create the site awareness. But it's more than that. It can be used by racks, by enclosures, by JBots, by chassis in blade servers. And the health service can use those to say, hey, your disk has gone bad in enclosure or JBot number 4, which is in rack number 5. That sort of information. And of course, storage spaces itself leverages the fault domains to make sure that the redundant copies are truly as best as possible in separate fault domains. Because it's kind of silly to have 3 copies in the same rack if you have 3 racks within your solution. Then it will do that, and it has that information. So that's quite cool. Another thing that some people don't always associate with clustering, but, well, you should, it's distributed storage class policies. So in 2012 R2, we already had storage class. On the disk level, you could say, hey, this is the minimum IOPS this disk gets. That was just a warning. It would trigger an event, hey, I'm not meeting my minimum IOPS. If you're looking for this event, you can do something about it. If you're not looking for this event, you don't know, even know, whatever. And then there is the maximum IOPS, which was enforced. If you said you can only have 5,000 IOPS, that disk would only get 5,000 IOPS. But you set it completely individually at the virtual disk level, and it wasn't distributed. So it only knew about its own LUM, so to speak. That VM knew, I have a maximum IOPS of 5,000, and that's my limit. It was unaware of the rest of the environment. So that changes. So what you now have is you can set policies that work across the cluster. And you can have multiple types of policies. You have the aggregated policies, which is basically saying, hey, I create a policy of 20,000 IOPS. Those 20,000 IOPS can be consumed by each and every VM with virtual disk that is assigned to this policy. If it's one VM, that VM potentially can get 20,000 IOPS. If it is 100 VMs, well, they have to share it. And they share it per disk. You don't have to assign every disk to the same policy. You can play with that. You could have a different policy for the OS disk and another policy for the data disks. So you could set the IOPS on the OS disk low enough to make sure every DBA that puts its database on the C drive is getting hurt. And, you know, decides, perhaps they promised me 20,000 IOPS, I'm not getting it. What am I doing wrong? And then you can tell them, did you put it on the D disk or the E disk? Okay, then they know what to do. And then you have the dedicated policies. The dedicated policies are truly dedicated to the resource that gets it. So if you say a dedicated policy is assigned to this disk, it will get 20,000 IOPS. It works on the failout scale server, but it also works on block level storage. And this, I think, is quite unique in the industry. I do not, you know, all this talk about if you want to do cross, you need file share storage. That's something that was discussed and talked about a lot in the storage industry. And now all of a sudden Microsoft says, hey, if you have block level CSV, size, SCSI, fiber channel, these policies work, and they do. So we think that's pretty cool. And we think it's so cool that I will demo this. So let me get back to my cluster. And you have a picture, great. So normally we should have two virtual machines here. This is the first, and this is the second. Let's start some IOPS. Now the thing to note is virtual machine three here is generating IOPS against two virtual disks, while virtual machine four is only generating IOPS against one virtual disk. So what I'm going to do now is start my demo for this one. That's demo three. So we have no default policies, so both of these VMs with their disks are grabbing all the IOPS they can. And basically, the limits they have now is due to the processors I set, because the storage can provide even more IOPS. Now let's create some storage policies. So I'm creating three tiers of aggregated policies. And take a look at that aggregated tier one policy. It says a maximum of 10,000, right? Remember that one. Now we create dedicated storage class policies. And again, look at the dedicated tier one policy. Again, 10,000 IOPS maximum. So now we're going to play. We are going to assign aggregated policies to the VMs. That tier one policy is now being applied. And if the demo gods are with me, what are we seeing? Well, the IOPS for VM3 dropped to 3,000, and the IOPS for VM4 dropped to 3,000, and the IOPS for VM3 dropped to 6,000 or something like that. It varies a bit, but that has two disks running. So in total, there's three disks in play, and they have an aggregated policy so that 10,000 IOPS is divided amongst the three disks. That's an aggregated policy in action. So now let's do the other thing. Let's assign a dedicated policy. And let's see what happens. There we go. It's stabilizing. So VM4 is getting 10,000 IOPS. VM3 is getting 20,000 IOPS. Why? Anybody? It's a dedicated policy. Two disks. It's guaranteed per disk, so 2 times 10,000 is 20,000, and the other one is only working against one disk, so it gets 10,000. So that's how you can create policies and try to mix and match your needs. But it's now a lot easier, and the policies are distributed. Of course, if you do this against a SAN, and you have multiple clusters running against that SAN, those clusters don't know about each other. So it's distributed within the cluster. It's not aware of, a Linux with Hadoop you're running against the SAN. If that's consuming 1 million IOPS from that SAN, and this one has policy sets, it can't say, hey, I can't give you, it can't know about all the other workloads. But it's a really nice step within that cluster entity to have your storage class policies aware of what's happening within the cluster. And with that, I would say, I'm going to open up the room for questions, and I need to do one last thing. And that's, of course, put up the sponsor slide. So, any questions? Any remarks, feedback, ideas? Oh, a quiet room. Either I was very, very clear, or I scared you, or... You're all laughing, so you didn't fall asleep. That's good.
Nice new features. I think the deprecated command with low and no priority is a good decision. Yeah. Nice and was policy. And, good showcase.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Great. So, that was it for me. Thank you very much.